Good day, and welcome to the 16th presentation of the Inside the Beltway conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Cassandra, thank you very much. Hello, everybody. We've got quite the attendance today, 1,300 people registered for this call, so we're very excited to be with you all. As the operator mentioned, I'm Fred Riche. I'm head of what we call at the law firm here, the Financial Services ERISA team, meaning that we represent clients who provide products and services to retirement plans, service providers. That includes registered investment advisors, broker-dealers, insurance companies, bank and trust companies, mutual funds, on and on. With me today are two other speakers. One is Jim Dolan, who is with Natixis. Jim heads up the retirement plan area for them. The other is Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. And as many of you all know, Brad was a former assistant secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, which under the current administration, Brad was of the prior administration, but under the current administration, that's the agency that has driven the fiduciary rule. Today's session is being recorded, which is good because it'll allow you to re-listen to it if you want, or if you want to refer some of your colleagues to it, you can do that as well. It'll be posted in a few days on our website, www.drinkerbettle.com, under a tab that's labeled Resources. Better than that, though, we'll send you an email. If you've registered for the program, we will send an email to your registration address that has a link once it's posted. So you're all set if you registered for the program. With that background, Jim, let me turn it over to you for a few minutes. And as a part of that, let me thank you and Natixis for your great support for these programs. You've allowed us to bring a lot of educational content to the marketplace at a time when it's really important. So, Jim?
Thank you, Fred. It's a pleasure, and we're grateful for the partnership. I did want to take a moment and thank everyone for calling in today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your day to join us. I want to thank Fred Riche. I want to thank Brad Campbell for this partnership, and I want to thank Drinker Biddle. We've been doing this for about 4 years, and we're grateful that we can bring this type of information to the marketplace. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Natixis, I just wanted to take a moment and tell you about our firm. And we seek to serve thoughtful investment professionals worldwide with more insightful ways to invest. We do this through a process called durable portfolio construction. We apply risk-minded insights to empower more intelligent investing. We draw from deep investor and industry insights, and we partner closely with our clients to put objective data behind these discussions. Natixis is ranked among the world's largest asset management firms. We unite over 20 specialized investment managers globally with just under $900 billion of assets under management. We bring a diverse range of solutions to every strategic opportunity. It's from insights to action that Natixis helps our clients better serve their own with more durable portfolios. So I'd invite you to learn more about our firm by visiting durableportfolios.com. And with that, Fred, I'll turn it back to you to start the call.
Hey, thanks, Jim.
My pleasure.
Well, as you all know, we now have a final regulation defining fiduciary advice with a very broad definition. And we also have two exemptions from prohibited transaction rules that I refer to as the sales exemptions. What I mean by that is that there are a couple of prohibited transaction rules in ERISA and in the Internal Revenue Code that apply specifically to fiduciaries. And therefore, when an advisor becomes a fiduciary, those two prohibited transaction rules apply. And as the label suggests, they prohibit transactions. And more importantly, they prohibit your compensation. So it's a big deal. That's why I would say they're part of the sales process, because of the prohibition on the compensation for advisors making recommendations. They're called 84-24 and the best interest contract exemption, and we'll get into them in a minute. But those two exemptions allow exceptions to the prohibited transactions, because obviously investments have to be recommended and sold. Insurance products have to be recommended and sold. And I'm not going to leave you just hanging there, but and we'll get into those to a greater degree. But I want you to understand the structure. You have a broad fiduciary definition. You have two prohibited transactions, but then you have two prohibited transaction exemptions that say if you satisfy their conditions, then you can go ahead, make recommendations, or make sales, and receive compensation in return for that. So that's the big picture. That all becomes effective April 10, 2017. In other words, you know, a little less than a year from now. So you've got time to adjust, but it's important that you understand the rules today, because it's going to take some considerable adjustments. New procedures, new policies, new forms, new disclosures, on and on. You got to be ready for April 10, 2017. Brad, with that background, why don't you pick up from there? Tell us a little bit about how the program is going to be structured today, and maybe talk a little bit about where we are in terms of these rules actually coming into effect on April 10 of next year.
Well, you bet, Fred. And again, thanks to all of you for taking the time to join in. We really do appreciate it. I just want to echo what Fred said by starting out is that, as you could, you know, listen to the types of things Fred was bringing up as to what's going to change and what needs to be done. One, I think a year is too little time, but unfortunately it's the time we have, so it's the time we're going to have to figure out how to make work, which is going to require us to really pay some attention to this. Two, if there are any of you out there who think that this just isn't going to affect you in some way, I think you're probably wrong. The reality is, whether you're already a level fee advisor, whether you're already a fiduciary to a plan, 321 or 338, in all likelihood, especially if any of you deal with rollovers, you're going to have to change something in how you're operating or how you're being compensated and what you're disclosing, et cetera. So this really is an all-hands-on-deck evolution, to use a Navy term I'm not really entitled to use. So let's jump into what some of those changes were, and I'll try to identify some that are changes from the proposal, but a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is changes from current law, because that's probably the most significant thing we need to focus on at this point, a little more so than sort of who shot John on what things were changed. Most specifically, the definition of what's fiduciary advice is significantly expanded, both in terms of its practical application to different groups and what conduct itself is fiduciary. So in the first part, what I meant is, they are clarifying, and while this was in fact the case before, in practical effect, people viewed it differently. This definition applies with respect not just to plans and plan participants and beneficiaries, ERISA plans, but also to IRAs and IRA owners. Now, again, that is technically true that that was the case in the past, but that's not how I think a lot of the regulated community thought about it. So this applies to IRAs as well as to plans and plan participants. And probably the four biggest categories of advice that are worth focusing on. One, of course, making investment recommendations continues to be investment advice. But three others are new and are pretty significant in their effect. One is that if you're making a recommendation regarding a distribution or a rollover from a plan or an IRA, and that includes whether to do a rollover, not just where the money goes or how it should be invested once it gets there, but whether a rollover itself should be done, that's now fiduciary advice. And that's a direct change from current law, where the department had previously said that in most cases, rollover advice was not fiduciary in nature. Let me key in on the two parts of that. It's not just rollovers that are fiduciary, but also recommendations about distributions. So if you're talking to someone about an RMD, required minimum distribution, or if you're someone who is having a financial services conversation maybe outside of retirement, for example, you're talking to someone about whether they should buy whole life insurance for estate planning, or you're talking to them about long-term care policies and where to find the money to buy those, if you're recommending they take it as a distribution from an IRA, that could well be and probably is fiduciary advice under this rule. So there's a very significant expansion in this part with respect to rollovers and distribution advice. Also, a recommendation, and this was brand new in the final rule, something we had not seen previously, a recommendation about the type of account a participant or an IRA owner should use, for example, brokerage versus fee-based, is itself a fiduciary recommendation, as is recommending a fiduciary advisor. So if you're getting paid to recommend who should advise a participant or who should advise an IRA owner, that recommendation is itself fiduciary advice. So you add all those together and you have a very significant expansion of what conduct is now fiduciary, which, as Fred said, results in all these questions about how you're getting paid and whether it's compliant with that. Now, DOL did clarify that marketing your services is not fiduciary advice. So, for example, simply saying, I provide rollover advice assistance is not a recommendation. That's not fiduciary advice. But if you actually recommend whether someone should take a rollover, for example, that would be fiduciary advice. Go ahead.
Let me jump in for a second on the fiduciary rule. It just as additional background to what Brad said, all of those recommendations are, in fact, fiduciary advice. And the way that IRAs are brought into the picture is that a recommendation to an owner of an IRA, a fiduciary recommendation that results in a prohibited transaction under the Internal Revenue Code, can only be enforced by the IRS under current law. The Department of Labor can't enforce it. There's no right of private litigation to enforce violations of the Internal Revenue Code. So what the Department of Labor did was something that was very clever. They said, if you give advice to an IRA that creates a prohibited transaction, that is, it causes you to be paid additional money or it causes you to get a payment from a third party like an insurance commission or a 12B1 fee, that's a prohibited transaction. And the DOL said, but we'll give you an exemption because the DOL has the authority to write the prohibited transaction exemptions for the Internal Revenue Code. I realize that's very odd. They can't enforce them, but they can write them. What the DOL said then was, however, one of the conditions for you to get conflicted investment, for you to be able to benefit or to deliver conflicted investment advice to an IRA, as they call advice that results in a prohibited transaction, is we're going to require you to enter into a contract with the IRA owner that's called the best interest contract. You've probably heard that expression, BIC or BICE. And in the contract, you agree, in effect, to serve as a fiduciary and to adhere to the fiduciary rules, the fiduciary standard of care. And if you don't, then the investor can sue you for breach of contract. That's how they built in a standard of care where none existed previously. But that tells you another thing that you may not have thought about, which is if you're a pure level fee advisor, that is, if you give advice to an IRA and all you and your supervisory entity, like your broker-dealer or RIA, and any affiliates, you know, any other companies that are associated with you and your supervisory entity, if your level fee, let's just say 100 basis points a year, 1% per year, and that's all anybody gets. That's all any affiliated entity, you or your supervisor entity, get. That is pure level fee. Pure level fee isn't a prohibited transaction. As Brad said, you can say, hire me. So if you don't have a prohibited transaction because you're a pure level fee advisor to an IRA, you don't have to agree to the best interest standard of care. And you don't have to satisfy any of the conditions and any of the exemptions because you're not committing a prohibited transaction. So that's the one place of all the different kinds of advice that we're going to talk about that you're not subject to the prohibited transaction conditions and that you're not subject to the best interest standard of care. I think everything else we'll talk about, you will, in fact, be subject to a fiduciary or best interest standard of care, and you'll have to satisfy the conditions that we talk about. So, Brad, back to you. Well, I just wanted to clarify that.
No, that's a great point, and let me just follow up and clarify one other thing, because I think it's an important point. You're describing a case where you're already advising someone in an IRA, and you're charging a level fee, and no one else in your entire chain-affiliated world makes anything more than that level fee. Then, yes, this isn't changing that. But if you actually give rollover advice, the fact that you're going to charge a level fee still would have a prohibited transaction. I just want to emphasize that because that's one area where even being level fee is not getting you off the hook, is in these rollovers and some of the potential distribution advice. I just want to say that because I think it's easy to get confused, especially since DOL has also called some of the exemptions in the BIC exemption level fee. So we have a lot of different uses of the phrase level fee that mean different things, and it's all easy for us to get confused. This is probably a good point because you had mentioned DOL's authority and how it's using the prohibited transaction rules and the tax code to create the exemptions and so forth, which naturally brings up the question of whether they in fact have the authority to do that. And that's probably a point that we are likely to see brought up in litigation. At this point, in terms of just very briefly about the future prospects of this rule, it's likely that litigation will be brought suggesting that DOL has done things here that they don't have the authority to do, suggesting that they've made arbitrary and capricious decisions or that they haven't followed the proper process for promulgating a rule. That litigation, I think, is likely to be filed. Whether it'll succeed, you know, who knows? That's a question that we're not going to handicap in terms of whether the courts are going to decide with the people filing that. That's one potential avenue that could slow or alternatively halt this rule. We have to plan, though, as if it's going to survive that and continue forward, because 1 year just isn't that much time to get ready. Alternatively, as you probably read in the press, Congress is already working on resolutions disapproving the rule as part of its responsibility under the Congressional Review Act, which gives Congress 60 legislative days to give an up or down vote on a rule like this. The problem, though, is it appears that the vote that's going to occur in the House shortly will probably be party line, and President Obama has already issued a veto threat. So, even if those resolutions move forward, it's unlikely that they're going to move forward with a veto-proof majority. So it's unlikely Congress is going to, at least in the short term, be able to do anything to address this rule. Litigation may or may not. But given those prospects, I think all of us still have to focus on compliance and moving forward. So getting back to what was in the rule, and again, we just want to go through these basic provisions so we're all on the same page before we start talking about particular applications. DOL still did retain specific exclusions of activity that's not advice, and that continues to include education, although there were some tweaks made to how you could use asset model allocation recommendations. They fix the wholesaler problem. In other words, if you're talking to a fiduciary who is a financial professional affiliated with a bank, an RIA, an insurance company, a broker-dealer, then that conversation doesn't result in fiduciary advice. There's a sophisticated fiduciary exclusion where if you're talking to a fiduciary who manages more than $50 million in assets, that with the appropriate disclosures, that would not be a fiduciary conversation. And there's an exemption for platform providers for providing platform services and also responding to RFPs under certain limitations, that would not be advice as well. So that general structure from the proposal is still there with some significant tweaks here and there about what is and isn't advice.
You know, Brad, a couple of interesting comments on that. As you said, the Department of Labor more or less restored Interpretive Bulletin 96-1. You know, that may mean something to the audience for me to cite to that or not, but that's participant investment education. That's the prior guidance on it. And the Department of Labor said, yes, you can have asset allocation models for participant education for retirement plan participants. And you can even populate them with mutual funds, so from the core lineup of the plan. That's different from the proposal, but in the final, they do let you populate the asset allocation model, something that I haven't heard any speakers on any program speak about so far, though, is the DOL then went on to say, however, the plan sponsor has a duty to evaluate that to make sure that it isn't biased in terms of the proprietary product or revenue-sharing funds on the provider's platform, because often those asset allocation models are prepared by the provider. But anyway, they enhance the duty of the plan sponsor to oversee that, which worries me a little bit because I don't know that most plan sponsors are truly capable of doing that. In any event, I think that's a fairly significant change. On the wholesalers, I know what I was going to say, but they did not do that for IRAs. You cannot have populated asset allocation models for IRAs. If you do, that's considered fiduciary investment advice, not education. Now, you can do it, but it's advice, not education. So, in other words, it's a fiduciary activity. On the wholesalers, and this is really just an aside, Brad, but it seems to, I mean, a retirement plan wholesaler or an insurance wholesaler or a mutual fund wholesaler can meet with an advisor and explain their products and services and even tout them, because the Department of Labor believes that advisors are sophisticated enough to tell the difference between a sales pitch and fiduciary advice. But what becomes interesting is when the wholesaler goes face-to-face with the investor. Let's say the advisor brings the wholesaler into a meeting. It seems to me that a retirement plan wholesaler can come in and talk about, you know, the platform, the services, the websites, the participant materials, and all that stuff. And that wouldn't make the retirement plan wholesaler a fiduciary if they limit their conversations to those non-fiduciary activities, even in a face-to-face meeting with a customer. But I've been trying to think about mutual fund wholesalers and insurance wholesalers who can meet alone with the advisor and tout their products and services and not become a fiduciary. But if they're taken into face-to-face meetings with customers, I don't know what they have to talk about other than their investments or insurance products. I can't think of what they could talk about in terms of services and other related activities, but without discussing a specific investment product that they manufacture. So I think it may curtail the activities of insurance, and at least there's a risk that it could curtail the activities of mutual fund and insurance wholesalers in working with advisors or working and being able to go face-to-face with customers. So that's an issue that we're going to have to see developed a little more as people become more familiar with these rules. Back to you, Brad.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. That's kind of a theme for a lot of this is in terms of who's providing these education materials, we're going to see some tweaks, I think, made to how you approach that and who's willing to provide education and at what cost and on what terms. You know, for example, Fred was just discussing the ability to populate those asset allocation models with respect to plans. One other important clarification is DOL said, not only is it only plans, but you can only reference the designated investment alternatives of the plan. So if the model you're populating includes any sort of off-menu investments, and one example might be TIPS, inflation-protected treasuries, then you're not going to have this be education. It's going to be advice. So there's still wrinkles there to be concerned about as well. So moving on, that's kind of the general structure of the rule. We have these new fiduciary activities. We have clarification and redefinition of some of the exclusions of what's not advice. Then, of course, one of the big issues, as Fred discussed, is the creation of this new best interest contract exemption to allow some of the behavior which is now prohibited to continue under certain terms. And there were a variety of changes made to the best interest contract exemption. For example, they divided up the way that it treats ERISA plans and ERISA participants from the way it treats IRA owners and other creatures of the tax code like HSAs or covered LESAs or something else you might be advising that are not the ERISA plans. So the main difference is that when you're dealing with an IRA, that's where you're going to have to actually sign a contract between the financial institution and the IRA owner in which the financial institution is making representations and warranties in that contract to do things like identify all the material conflicts of interest and mitigate those, make a whole bunch of disclosures that are required. For example, disclosures at the time you enter into the arrangement, there are transaction-based disclosures, there are disclosures that have to be maintained on the website and updated quarterly, of course, that is subject to enforcement in state court in a class action for breach of contract. Now, DOL did clarify a few of the administrative housekeeping details there. They said that this BIC contract could be incorporated into the other documents that you use when you're opening a new account with an IRA owner. They don't have to be a standalone special document. There can still be binding arbitration for individual disputes but they have to reserve the right for a class action. So in other words, if I and my broker have a problem about a specific thing to me, we can still be required to go to binding arbitration. But if that problem I have with my broker is common to every contract, and we, all of us, rise up and say you did it wrong to all of us, that has to have the right to go forward as a class action. So on the IRA side, you have this actual contract in state court that's a written document. You were saying, Brad?
Let me jump in for a second, Brad, and just to add a couple things to what you said. Interestingly, the Department of Labor treats non-ERISA tax-qualified plans as IRAs for this purpose. So if you're working with a client with a solo 401k plan or with a one-person KEO plan such that it's not an ERISA plan, then you do have to have a contract because it's treated the same as an IRA rather than the same as an ERISA retirement plan, because it's not an ERISA retirement plan under the ERISA coverage rules. So keep that in mind, because that's something that could slip by. Also, to emphasize something that Brad said, the contract is between the financial institution and the IRA owner or the KEO owner. It's not between the advisor. The advisor is not a party to the contract. So that means the broker-dealer or the RIA firm signs a contract with the investor. There's some places where that creates some interesting issues. For example, with the new rule moved fixed indexed annuities out of the insurance exemption 8424 over under BICE, which Brad is talking about. And the what I'm hearing is that by and large insurance companies are not keen on signing on as a co-fiduciary financial institution with people that they have agency selling agreements with, but that they don't really supervise. So there are some issues arising about which financial institution. Is it going to be the insurance company? Is it going to be the broker-dealer? Is it going to be the RIA? Which financial institution is actually going to supervise the activities of the agent, particularly in that one case, or of the advisor? And sign the contract, because they have to agree to be co-fiduciaries, and they have to agree that institutionally, as well as the individual advisor, they're going to adhere to the best interest standard of care and a bunch of other stuff. And then the last thing is that in the proposal, the Department of Labor said that in so many words, they said that the contract, the best interest contract, had to be signed at about the time of the first conversation. They've now said that it can be a point of sale signature, but that it has to be retroactive for all advice given in all of the preceding conversations. So it's a little more workable in that regard. Those are just the points I wanted to hit, Brad.
Yeah, no, those are good points. And so, again, as I said, they split up the world between the ERISA and the non-ERISA. So you have the written contract on the non-ERISA. On the ERISA side, the significant change is you don't have to have a written contract, although you do have to provide notice. And otherwise, though, you're essentially abiding by all the same terms and provisions that would be in the contract. It's just there isn't a written contract. The other big change is that the ERISA side is subject now to exclusively the federal ERISA remedies and not to state court actions. This is a change the DOL will put in the final rule that I think addressed a lot of comments and, frankly, from their perspective, litigation risk, that they were creating alternative remedies to ERISA's exclusive remedies. So they address that. So if you're going to be using the BIC exemption with a plan, you don't enter into a contract, but you're basically doing the same things as you would in that IRA context. They took out the asset list, which is an important change. In the proposal, they said you could only use the BIC exemption if you were advising about assets that were on DOL's list of approved assets. They've now removed that list, so anything that's legal for an IRA to hold or a plan to hold as an asset, you can advise on and can use the BIC exemption for more significantly, more accurately, I should say, you can use the BIC exemption to advise on. There is a grandfather provision that the BIC exemption provides in terms of allowing some existing relationships to continue, but it is still very limited. As we've read it, I initially, when I read it, thought it was a little more broad than I now think it is, having read the details and tried to apply it to some factual situations. The grandfather provision says that you can continue to receive compensation in arrangements that you entered into that were valid prior to April of next year until they're up for renewal or expiration, but it doesn't really allow you to add new money. It doesn't really allow you to provide ongoing advice. There's still some debate of exactly what it means, but it's still quite a limited provision. Nonetheless, it may be helpful to facilitate a transition for those folks who are running into problems getting everything in place by next April. The other major change that's in the BIC exemption is the level fee option. And what this is, you know, some folks, I like to call it BIC Lite just to distinguish from all the other uses of the phrase level fee. What this means is that if you are going to be providing advice for a level fee going forward, so let's say you're talking to a participant about a rollover, after they roll over, you're charging them a level fee. And the only fee that you or any of your affiliates are going to receive is that level fee. Then you can have a sort of expedited disclosure, an expedited process for exempting the rollover transaction itself that would otherwise be prohibited. So you have to abide by the impartial conduct standards, which means you have to charge reasonable fees, make no materially misleading statements, and adhere to a fiduciary standard. And you also have to document why, in the case of rollovers or type of contract recommendations, type of account recommendations, why it's in the best interest of the participant to engage in the rollover. So if you can meet that limitation on the compensation, this is a much more practical way for level fee advisors, at least, to be able to handle rollovers in some other situations. But that doesn't mean it's easy necessarily, and I think one thing that's important to point out there is in order to determine that it's in the best interest of that participant, you're going to have to actually know what their previous plan, you know, what the investments are, what the fees are, what the services are, what the distribution options are, in order to assess whether the IRA is in fact in their best interest based on its cost, its services, its features, its distribution options, et cetera. And you have to go through and write down and document why that's still in the best interest. So in a case where you're an advisor to the plan and you have access to all that information, that'll be relatively straightforward, not entirely straightforward, but much more relatively straightforward. If, however, you're cold calling someone, for example, and you have to try to get all that information about the plan they're rolling over from, that may present some issues, practically speaking, going forward. Any thoughts on that, Fred?
No, I think that's true. I think that advisors who work with retirement plans are going to be advantaged in two ways. One, if, like you said, if they're already working with the plan, then they'll have the information about the investments and the expense ratios of the investments and the other costs of the plan. So it'll be a lot easier for them to do that analysis. And two, just because they're retirement plan advisors so familiar with these concepts, they'll know, for example, to ask a participant in a plan they don't work with to give them a copy of the investment comparative chart because they know what an investment comparative chart is. It is a great advantage to a pure level fee advisor who specializes in retirement plans, or who at least has a substantial focus on retirement plans. I would point out the rationale, by the way, is for why they give this expedited so-called level fee fiduciary, as Brad said, buy-slide. I like to call it mini-buys. But by any label, the reason that you have to go through these hoops is because there is a conflict of interest. For example, if you're not working with the plan, you're making zero. If you persuade the participant to roll over, you're now making, hypothetically, 1% per year. So your conflict of interest is 1% per year. And that's why these hurdles, the DOL is putting these hurdles in place. And there is an option, which is distribution and rollover education. There's no rule that says you have to make a recommendation. Alternatively, you could say to a participant, you know, this is one of the most important decisions of your lifetime. What I think isn't that important. What's really important is that you make an informed decision that's right for your future, because this may be the single largest movement of money in your entire life. Let's talk about that. and then have an educational process, which I think involves a brochure that has the different alternatives and considerations on it, so you can show you actually gave them educational materials. I think it involves a script of talking about, you know, three or four or five really important things, just to explain them and then to answer questions. And then an acknowledgement in your account opening form or your advisory agreement where the participant acknowledges that no recommendation was made, but instead they were provided with information and they made the decision on their own. That's sort of a three-step process that I would like to see if you're going to go the education route rather than the recommendation route.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, this is another case where we're going to see this rule affecting a lot of people, not just actual sort of financial advisors, in terms of, you know, a lot of platform providers who have been providing rollover services are going to have to look at how their call centers operate, are going to have to review their processes to make sure that they've are operating in a way that they intend to be, so that the right entities within their groups are providing recommendations versus education and so forth. So
one little twist there, Brad, is that, as you said earlier, a referral or recommendation of a fiduciary is a fiduciary act. Some call centers have arrangements with broker-dealers and RIAs that if a participant with a distribution of over, say, $100,000 calls in, they will refer that participant to the fiduciary advisor, what will be a fiduciary advisor for the plan. That looks somewhat like a referral to a fiduciary by the record keeper's call center. I'm not saying it is. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying if I were overseeing a call center, I would make sure to have my lawyers look at that issue and figure out what the considerations are, what I should be thinking about.
Yeah, because remember, it also has to be for a fee. So then there's a question of, is there actually a fee being charged in connection with that referral as well, and how you would define that. So, yeah, I would certainly agree. That's an example I would say that's true of virtually everything we're talking about here. Once you get down to the level of actually applying it to a particular set of facts, you're going to have a whole bunch of these types of issues come up that you need to dig through. One other thing I did want to clarify on that rollover question and the level fee BIC exemption, this is one case where this regulation has actually clarified something that may be helpful to some advisors, because under the current rules, if you're a fiduciary to a plan now and a participant comes to you and says, I want you to help me with my rollover, DOL has said in that circumstance it was already fiduciary advice, and they had went on to say in an advisory opinion this regulation repeals, essentially, that there may be a prohibited transaction to do that, but it may not. We didn't know whether it was a PT or not. It was a legal gray area. One advantage of this level fee, mini BIC, BIC light, whatever you want to call it, option, is that there now is no gray area on that. It is a prohibited transaction, but if you're that level fee advisor, there is now a process to address it. So for those of you who are, say, retirement specialist advisors who just didn't do personal wealth, didn't do rollovers, and part of your reason for staying away was the lack of clarity about when there was a prohibited transaction, that issue actually is resolved by this. So that may be an opportunity for some level fee advisors who weren't doing rollovers and weren't doing IRAs to look at starting to do that.
Brad, let's move on to what we're actually seeing happening as people are beginning to make decisions about these rules. And I'll start off with investment advice to plans. It seems to me that almost any investment advice, any investment recommendation, the definition of recommendation in the fiduciary rule is a suggestion, literally the word suggestion, to take a particular course of action with regard to investments. And that could be a buy or a sell or a hold recommendation. So it's going to be very hard going forward to talk to fiduciaries of plans about the investments without becoming a fiduciary advisor. In other words, the Department of Labor has drafted an all-encompassing, almost, regulation. So what decisions are going to be made around that by broker-dealers and RIAs? I think you'll find that people will fall into three or four categories, almost all of them, I believe, maybe not a few, but almost all of them, are going to be level fee. That is, everybody I'm talking to so far, at least, is thinking about charging level fee basis points or dollar amounts for advice to plans. So It could be 25 basis points. It could be $10,000. But what level fee means in this context is that all that the advisor supervisor entity and all affiliates get is that 25 basis points in my hypothetical. But even there, it's going to subdivide. I think that most RIAs, maybe all RIAs, and some broker dealers are going to have fiduciary advice programs for plans where they charge a level fee. So, for example, it's pretty obvious how the RIAs will do that. What the broker dealers, I think, will do is their most sophisticated retirement plan advisors will be part of a program within the broker dealer where they can serve as representatives of the corporate RIA, the dual registrant broker dealer RIA, and provide peer level fee advice. So I think we're going to that's already happening, and I think we'll see an acceleration of that. The second scenario is where the broker dealer will say that some, the less sophisticated advisors, or maybe all their advisors, have to can only refer to record keeping platforms that have a 321 third-party fiduciary, meaning a non-discretionary third-party fiduciary. Most platforms have that already. Soon enough, they'll all have them, maybe even multiple 321s on the same platform. And what I think the role of the 321 will be to select a range of investments, maybe 100 investments that the third-party fiduciary advisor stands behind. And then the individual advisors representing the broker-dealer can select within that, if you will, certified or warranted subset to pick a lineup for the plan of 15 or 20 mutual funds, but all of which are certified as prudent at some level by the third-party 321. Another alternative to that, particularly for less sophisticated advisors, is that the broker-dealers will require that they work with a platform that has a 338. Investment manager, a third-party 338. 338 is just industry lingo for a discretionary investment manager that will pick the mutual fund lineup and then will remove and replace them. In other words, there's no 100 fund list. They just do it. They pick and remove. They monitor, remove, and replace on an ongoing basis. So, but I think in almost all of those cases, I think it'll be level fee. There may be some exceptions where the broker-dealer has associated investment products, in which case the minute you have an affiliated mutual fund manager and you put that on into a plan, you're no longer level fee because you have your fee, plus there's the mutual fund management fee. That would require the best interest contract exemption. But by and large, I think it'll be the first three scenarios that I described. Brad, that's what I'm saying. Is that similar for you?
Yeah, that is similar. I think there's some additional wrinkles, and I would start out by saying that we are not seeing really one-size-fits-all approach here. Which of these makes the most sense, and there's some other options as well. It really is a very individualized determination for the broker-dealer or the RIA or, you know, whoever the sort of distribution mechanism is, because it really does – which ones make sense or which ones are even feasible depend entirely on what you're currently doing and how you're set up and what the ability of your advisory force is to be fiduciaries or to have the right licenses or, you know, just a host of related issues. Some of the other things we've heard some people talk about, and it's sort of in connection with some of the ones Fred mentioned, is there a way, for example, to have a level fee but just offset, use a Frost offset mechanism to not have to have a prohibited, you know, not to have to use BICE or something even though you're getting third-party compensation? Could you use the PPA computer model advice to augment what you're doing, sort of maybe be that pass-through 321 Fred referenced so that you can use that method? There's just a variety of options that might work well or better for particular advisors that aren't in kind of that primary group that Fred mentioned. I do want to emphasize one thing Fred said, which is if you have proprietary products with which you're affiliated as an advisor, It's going to be very hard to escape using the BIC exemption because that's really the primary method that DOL has left to us for allowing you to give advice where you have proprietary products about which you're advising. And so, you know, just reminding you again about the BIC, so if there's one last thing we didn't finish explaining there, we have the mini BIC, the level fee option, but then within the sort of main BIC where you're doing the contract or you're providing the notice and doing all of those other requirements, there's really kind of two primary flavors of that. There's having variable compensation at the institution level, but level fee at the advisor level, or there's having variable compensation at both of those levels, the advisor and the institution. And if you're going to try and have that variation, then it has to be based on neutral factors that don't misalign the interests of the participants. So, you know, I think that's another thing people need to make sure they understand. If you go through the BIC exemption, it doesn't just automatically permit the same practices you've had before, just with extra hoops to jump through. It does still limit how you can receive and why you can receive variable compensation. So you'd have to justify and demonstrate how the compensation at the advisor level that varies, for example, is in fact based on some neutral factor, like the amount of effort required to advise on one product versus another, the amount of time, and then that it doesn't misalign the interest. So that's going to involve a lot of judgment calls, a lot of compliance costs, and frankly, a lot of legal risk of someone second-guessing the judgment you ultimately made about the degree of variation and why it's permissible or not. So, you know, there are flavors, there are degrees of using the BIC exemption that have maybe more compliance costs and more risk versus less compliance cost and less risk, but there's times you may have to use the BIC even if you otherwise could use some alternative simply because of proprietary products.
Yeah, Brad, let me mention a couple of things and then we'll go to questions because we're running behind on time. As Brad points out, that if the advisor's compensation, say a representative of a broker-dealer, is level, such that no matter what the advisor recommends, he's compensated the same, that frees up the broker-dealer and its affiliates, for example, an insurance company or a mutual fund manager, to receive more money, so long as in the aggregate it's reasonable. But in that neutral factors scenario that Brad mentioned, the advisor's compensation can actually vary some. What we're seeing is some of the broker-dealers I'm working with are thinking about going out and hiring third-party consultants. And let's say that third-party consultants come back and, consultant comes back and says, it's twice as hard to explain and service a individual variable annuity as it is a mutual fund portfolio. In that case, the advisor could receive twice as much income for an individual variable annuity as they could receive for a mutual fund portfolio. So that's what neutral factors means. How much more work is it? But because of that class action provision, people aren't going to just say, oh, my goodness, I think it takes about twice as much. Let's do it that way. They're actually going to go out and hire reputable, maybe even big-name consultants to do that kind of analysis of fear that they'll get sued on it someday. A couple quick things about rollovers and about recommending investments to IRAs, and then we'll go to questions. For the most part, when recommendations are made to IRAs, we already know from our prior discussion that if the advisor and all affiliated entities are pure level fee, you don't have to worry about any of this. But if advice is given to IRAs, and it includes proprietary mutual funds, other compensation, then all of a sudden you need the best interest contract exemption. And that's where either the advisor's compensation is going to be levelized, and that way all the affiliates can make more money, but not the advisor, or they're going to be those neutral factors. I think that broker-dealers who don't have affiliated products are going to be seriously looking at a pure level fee scenario for advice. Still has to be reasonable. It can't be an excessive amount, but there will be data soon enough on what's reasonable for compensation for IRAs. I do see some cases over RIAs who think that they're pure level fee or who see themselves that way are actually getting additional payments. Keep in mind that these rules define compensation as money or things of monetary value. If you're getting trips, if people are paying you to help you host events, If you're getting any money or anything of monetary value from any source, you really need to examine that to see if that causes you to lose the pure level fee situation such that you would have to comply with BICE. You'd have to have a website, all kinds of stuff. I mean, you don't want to do that. In terms of the other situations, maybe a broker-dealer that has an affiliated mutual fund company, they're going to have to comply with BICE in that scenario. They're going to have to do the full-blown best interest contract, all the disclosures, all the warranties, on the website, on and on. Then when we get to rollovers, we've really discussed those pretty thoroughly. I would just say that, you know, keep in mind there is the education alternative. I think most RIAs will probably go the education route, at least the ones I've talked to so far. Broker-dealers are in a little more difficult a situation because while an RIA firm with 1 or 5 or 10 or even 20 advisors can get together and plan and develop the products and services in a way that education can be delivered and they can monitor it, think about a broker-dealer with 5,000 or 10,000 advisors. It's much more difficult for them. Plus, there's a culture and a history that's more sales-oriented. So we're going to have to wait and see how that falls out. I think some will try to comply with BICE. I think others will go education, but that's still a work in process. Having said that, Cassandra, what do you say one last thought on that. What we said about rollovers also applies to a recommendation to transfer an IRA to you. If an IRA is with another advisor and you're recommending that it transfer to you, you have very, very similar considerations as to everything we said about distributions and rollovers. Cassandra, can we open it up for questions?
Certainly. If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is disengaged to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line has been opened. Please state your name before posing your question. And again, that is *1 to signal for a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to assemble the queue.
Well, Fred, while we're waiting for the queue to assemble, just a quick thought that I just emphasize something you just said. Most of what we're talking about right now is in connection with the structural payment issues. It's sort of the first shoe of the two that are dropping here. The first is how do we restructure so we can still provide advice and get paid in a manner that's compliant. The second is there really is a new fiduciary overlay on all of these decisions that for a significant part of the advisory marketplace has not traditionally been the way they've approached it. They're going to have to, there's sort of a paradigm shift in how they deliver advice, how they document it, how they think about it, they're going to have to go through. And that's kind of the other shoe to drop that I think is sort of the thing that we're thinking about next. First, people are thinking about the structure, but then the conduct, how we actually go about making recommendations is going to have to change for a lot of people as well.
Yeah, you know, just a footnote on that, Brad. In the level fee fiduciary discussion and BICE, as you know, but the audience might not, there's a provision in there that says you may have to recommend to the participant that they leave their money in the plan. And that's literally written in there. You've got to consider that, and if it's better for them to leave it there, you have to recommend that. Otherwise, it would be not a breach of the prohibited transaction rules, but a breach of the fiduciary rule that Brad's talking about. Operator?
And maybe both, actually, in that case.
And we'll take our first question.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes, we can.
Hi, my name is Aaron Cadell. I'm calling from Capstone here in Washington. And my question is about kind of the implementation and your view about when firms are likely to be fully prepared for the rule. We've been talking about the different compliance and legal structures that will have to be put in place based on either in the case of the gentleman from NetTexas or just for your clients. Do you think that people are looking to the April 2017 deadline? Are they looking at the January 2018 deadline for the full implementation of the BIC? Or are they looking at something earlier than that where to have the policies and procedures in place to be ready for the rule? As you said, a year is not that long in this context. So how do you think that'll play out? Do you think that all the structures will be in place in 6 months, in 4 years? It's just hard for us as a little bit outside this process to gauge that.
Yeah, I'm working with a large broker-dealer right now, and they've told me they want to start making their final decisions in June. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at beginning to make final decisions in June. I think to the extent they can, having those final decisions wrapped up in June and July, because they've got to do fiduciary training for their advisors. They have to develop policies. They have to develop supervisory procedures. They have to maybe develop with some new products or work with mutual fund families to develop different share classes that are better suited for this, strip out the 12b1 fee. I mean, on and on and on. For a big broker-dealer, I think the insurance companies, most of them, unfortunately, are a little behind the curve. I don't think they quite realize the impact this is going to have. So for insurance products, they might be a little bit later. They're waiting for feedback from the broker-dealers on what the broker-dealers want. Similarly, the mutual fund guys are trying to get feedback from the marketplace about what do advisors want in terms of new share classes and products. I think RIAs could actually wait a little bit longer because they tend to be smaller firms. Mm-hmm. But a big RIA firm is not so different from a broker-dealer, a little less complicated. But in terms of most, you know, regional or local RIA firms, you know, I think they could spend another couple months, maybe 2 months, digesting this, and then start to work on the solutions. But I wouldn't worry. I mean, I wouldn't wait till.
And in this example, that this client that you're working with, so by June or July, they will be making decisions on whether they will receive 12b1 fees or not, like that level of granularity, or is it more general?
Oh, much more detailed than that.
Got it.
That's general. Whether they're going to receive a 12b1 fee is general by these standards. No, exactly how they're going to deal with all the issues we've been talking about today. You know, some broker-dealers are going to receive them, as Rad said, and they're going to offset them against their advisory fees because they're going to go pure level fee. Others that have proprietary products have no choice but to go under BICE. A lot of things fall in place once you really get to know the rules.
Great, thank you. You know, I do have other questions, but I'll let others join in, so I'll jump back in the queue. Thank you very much, though.
Yeah, let me just follow up on one quick thought. What I'm seeing among clients is that it's all over the map in terms of how prepared they are. I generally agree with Fred that people, particularly large, complex institutions, probably need to have their decisions made by this summer if they have much of a realistic chance of implementing them. I'm not sure a lot of people are where they need to be on trying to figure this out. I'm very concerned that it's going to be hard for people to make that deadline of April. But, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, I'm sure we'll get there. But we're seeing a lot of people at different stages in the coming to terms with this process.
Yeah, I agree. Operator?
And we'll take our next question.
Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi, this is Bob from Lincoln. When we talk about BIC-Lite, we often talk about it as a rollover from a plan to an IRA. But suppose you had an advisor with a BD that's a level fee advisor, and he advises on rollovers into a plan. Would that advisor be able to use just Frost, or would he also have to then also have like a BIC-Lite approach under the plan?
Brad, do you want to jump in?
If you're setting it up so that the fee is actually level, so that an example I've heard from some advisors who are thinking about this is, hey, what if I've got a participant in a managed account that's costing 1% in the plan, and that's my fee for the managed account, and so they're now rolling over to an IRA with me at 1%, so the fee is level. Do I actually need to, yes, it's fiduciary advice, but is it also a privated transaction? Do I actually need to use BIC-Lite? And I think there's an argument that says that if the fee truly is level, what the advisor is receiving isn't changing, that probably you can do that, but we still need to look through that a little bit more. I mean, there are, you know, we've been talking on this call at sort of the big picture level. There are, you know, even if you might say something like you're always going to need an exemption when you give advice on a rollover, that's a bit of a generalization. It may be true 99% of the time, but there could be 1% of the time that there's a particular procedure that works for a particular group that isn't necessarily universally applicable. For example, I think it'd be very difficult for most advisors to figure out how to get paid the same in the IRA as they are in the plan to have that sort of level fee transaction occur.
Yeah, it's good, Brad. I guess I was thinking, if I'm in a plan today and it costs me, say, 20 basis points as a fee, and I leave this job and I go somewhere else, and that new plan is with an advisor that's a level fee, but he's at, say, 30, and he wants to advise me to get my money out of my old plan and put it into the new plan, and that new plan, he is a level fee advisor. Can he just do that under Frost, or would he need to also have...
I think
I was about to say, in that scenario, I think you're going to have to use the BICE level fee exemption.
Yeah, I agree. You made a recommendation. You made a fiduciary recommendation that increased your compensation. I don't see where, and it has to be in the best interest of the participant. If, let's say that the expenses in the old plan were lower, the mutual fund expenses were lower cost, in addition to the advisory fee, and let's say there were a lot of advantages to being in the old plan, then I think you can have an educational conversation. But if you make a recommendation, it has to be prudent and in the best interest of the participant. Plus, with an increase in fees that result from the recommendation, that's a prohibited transaction, and you need an exemption.
By the way, that's an interesting wrinkle to point out here. When you're doing enrollment meetings and education meetings with new hires, you can no longer kind of cavalierly say, hey, you really ought to roll over from your old plan to the new plan to consolidate and combat leakage and all the other good reasons that we've always said that. That's now fiduciary advice, which is probably also a prohibited transaction, as Fred just said. So that is going to be one of the ways in which how we interact with, you know, participants and plans and education could well change.
Operator, we have time for two more questions, and then we'll have to call it a day.
Okay, we'll take our next question.
Hello?
Hi, Fred. This is Mary Claire.
Hey, how are you?
Okay. I just want to clarify level fee. If there's an IRA with only non-proprietary mutual funds in it, and they each pay an identical 12B1 to the firm, and we don't get any other revenue sharing, is that prohibited because it's coming from a third party?
Yeah, any third party payment would be revenue sharing based on, you know, on assets, 12B1 fees.
Right. So completely 12B1 and only 12B1, and it's all level. It's still a problematic.
Yeah, if your advisor's charging, let's say, 150 basis points for advice, and you get the 12B1 fee, if you offset that against the 150 basis points, that's what Brad was talking about earlier when he referred to Frost. There's two advisory opinions, the Frost Bank and the Country Trust advisory opinions that endorse, if you will, that offset method. The other thing you can do is pay that amount over into the IRA. And you get essentially the same effect, which is you made a recommendation, but it did not increase the compensation of the advisor or of the broker-dealer or of any affiliate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in my example, we're not charging a fee at all. So I just, it's, you know, all 12B1s coming in completely level. It's still a problem just because they're coming from a third party.
There are two prohibited transactions. And people tend to only think about one. The first of the two, 406B1, just to show I'm a lawyer, and 4975C1E of the Internal Revenue Code, say that you can't give advice, in so many words, that increases your compensation. But there's also 406B3 and 4975C1F that say that you cannot receive payments from third parties. And the way you get around that, though, is you enter into an agreement with the IRA owner that says, we're going to charge you 25 basis points for all our services. We will offset any payments we get from the mutual funds against that. And, oh, yeah, by the way, we're going to get 25 basis points from all the mutual funds. Therefore, you will have no additional cost. So you achieve the same thing. You just document it properly.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Sure. Sure.
And we'll go to our next question.
Hey, thanks so much for this great call. A couple questions. Well, I'll focus on the main one that I've got here. Plan sponsors, I'm just curious what risks they might have if the advisor they've hired with a contract commits a prohibitive transaction, say they make inappropriate recommendations for rollovers or whatnot. Do they become a co-fiduciary to those acts, and is there a liability to the plan sponsor for a failure to, I guess, manage and supervise and monitor those they've outsourced to?
Well, let me throw out a couple thoughts and then turn it over to Brad. The plan sponsors have a duty to supervise service providers to the plans. So if it's like the call center of the record keeper, that's a service provider to plans. So there's a monitoring obligation, and plan sponsors need to know whether or not those call centers are acting as fiduciaries by making recommendations for rollovers and how to invest if a rollover occurs, or whether they're providing education. There are a variety of ways they can fulfill that responsibility, but they have a responsibility. The other scenario is where a plan sponsor allows advisors to come on premises. Let's say they allow one advisor to come on premises and talk to their employees, but they don't allow anybody else. There's at least a risk. The DOL could say that that's an endorsement of that person. Then if they talk about the plan investments or about plan distributions, they would become a fiduciary, and the plan sponsor is the one that allowed them to have the access to be that fiduciary. I have some worries that there's some risk there for the plan sponsor, not if they do it properly and if they make sure their full disclosures and prohibited transaction rules are satisfied, but if they just sort of allow it to happen without thinking it through, I have some risk. The third scenario would be where the plan sponsor doesn't even know what's going on, but somebody's just making a recommendation to their participants. Pretty hard to say they have any responsibility for that. Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say that to the extent, as you were saying, to the extent they're hiring, say, people to provide education or to provide advice to the participants, that's a service provider for whom they have a duty to monitor. And as long as they have a monitoring process, the fact that on a particular occasion somebody did something that was wrong, that doesn't mean that there was a breach by the plan sponsor. They are going to have to be able to show that they did have a monitoring process, though. If they have no monitoring process and that happens, it's going to be harder to defend themselves. Otherwise, I tend to agree with Fred. I mean, I would be cautious about the appearance of endorsing. And in terms of co-fiduciary liability in general, I don't think the plan is going to be responsible to the extent that they allowed something to happen through their inactivity or didn't carry out their functions or knew of something that was going on wrong but did nothing about it. So I don't think there's sort of a special co-fiduciary issue here from kind of an ERISA perspective, but it's something plans should think about. I mean, what we've seen with some of our larger plan sponsor clients is if they're a little more concerned about this and the potential for being perceived to endorse it, they might seek contract provisions in their service agreements that say the service provider will abide by all of the prohibited transaction rules and exemptions and will indemnify the plan against losses that result from that. I think the reality, though, is you have to be a pretty large plan to be able to get that kind of customized term in your contract.
Great.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'll do a follow-up on this in about 3 months, and we haven't figured out the date yet. We're going to accelerate the date some so we can get back with you all sooner rather than later. With that in mind, Jim, do you want to add a few words and say goodbye to everybody?
Certainly. Thank you, Fred. And thanks, Brad, for the insights on today's call. We appreciate it very much. Grateful for this partnership. I did want the callers to mark down July 28th. That's our goal. We're going to try to schedule our next call for the 28th. We've had a lot of interest on this call, certainly with 1,300 people calling in. Clearly, this information is very helpful. So July 28th, that will be our next call. And on behalf of Natixis Global Asset Management, I want to thank everyone who called in today for taking the time and your participation. And with that, I'll pass it over to Cassandra to close out the call.
And this does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.